to file with our Civilian Complaint Review Board. Where was the CCRB? Where was the former police commissioner? Where was the former mayor? There should have been an outrage over the fact that something that was banned under all circumstances, complaints of 1,022, someone missed doing their job. And I think we have to press for absolute adherence to prohibitions on chokeholds.
Should police wear cameras?
It's really tricky. I know the progressive community is saying that, but the cops are not going to be able to turn it on and off, because they'll turn it on and off when there's a favorable interaction. So are they going to be able to have surveillance 24/7? Is it going to be a database of all of us congregating and assembling? You could have a very Orwellian 1984 scenario in New York City and America. What I say to people, think through that advocacy of having cops have cameras on their uniforms.
We're going to continue this conversation after the show, and I want to encourage people to let people know about this conversation and to weigh in yourselves by writing to us at democracynow.org. I want to thank Edith Baez, mother of Anthony Baez, Katiadu Diallo, mother of Amadou Diallo, Deborah Goodman, arrested for filming the NYPD, and Norman Siegel. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Thanks for joining us.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kbu.fm. The time is 5:01. Stay tuned for the KBOO Evening News for this Tuesday, August 5th.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the second annual Portland Roots Festival, Sunday, August 10th, from noon to 8 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. The Portland Roots Festival explores the food justice movement, healthy living through nutrition and exercise, and celebrates the flavors of African diaspora food culture in an urban landscape. The celebration will feature local artists and performers, a keynote speaker, African, African-American, Afro-Latin, and Afro-Caribbean food vendors, local nonprofits, and micro-entrepreneurs.
Again, that's the second annual Portland Roots Festival, Sunday, August 10th, from noon to 8 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Do you worry that corporate power is totally out of control? Tune into the KBOO Evening News every Tuesday evening at 5 p.m. beginning August 5th to hear the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. I'll be sharing stories about communities that are rising up against corporate control and passing laws that exercise their right to govern themselves. That's every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News beginning August 5th. Don't miss it.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Native Americans in Portland gathered to protest a concert of Ted Nugent, a musician known for his racist views. We'll get an update from Gaza, where a 72-hour ceasefire has apparently gone into effect. And a local activist seeks help with an upcoming November ballot. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 5th, 2014. I'm Emily Young. For an update on the latest in the Gaza Strip, KBOO's Chris Andre spoke with Mohammed Al-Qahtani in Gaza City.
I want to ask you about, first off, the ceasefire. Can you tell me what you're seeing and how you feel, how the ceasefire affects you, and what your expectations are? Will it hold?
Recently in Gaza, it's pretty much calmed down with a lot of cautious, because we have very bad experience in a previous 3 or 5 ceasefire announced, even from our side, Palestinian side, even from Israeli side, from one side, I mean. But recently, alhamdulillah, for today, the people here, the life in general goes back normally. The people go to supermarket, goes to grocery, to find out what their needs, because, you know, during the 30 days of aggression against people here, they totally need to buy a lot of things to keep life goes on. Today also we receive electricity in most of area in Gaza Strip. I'm talking in Gaza City. I mean, for 3 hours almost, the electricity company tried to schedule the electricity among the Gaza City because we have living without electricity, neither water for 6 days. Today, people goes to the area which is declared as restricted area and military area. For example, Shajaid, people goes there to find out what's happening in that. I personally goes to my relatives' homes and to the Shajaid neighborhood, and actually what I found there, it's totally mess. I found my I goes in one street and by sudden I found myself goes to the next street, and I didn't recognize the building, anything. It's just demolished building. There is a lot of building have been totally destroyed, and it's composed of 4 stories, and the roof, you can walk in the roof in the street. People there, they try to gather their clothes, their stuff inside their homes. It's still useful for them to exit the Shijai, especially those who are lost their homes. For people who have partially destroyed their homes, they try to clean up their homes and to make it useful for them. One of my aunts, they goes to their homes and they will spend their nights there, looking forward to adhere the, and to extension the ceasefire and from both sides. This is what I can say for the moment about what happened in Gaza right now. When I speak to you just right now, the electricity goes off, and I want to tell you that we are normal people, just like you. We are not different from you. We would like to love and peace. We would like to take our children to the beach. We would like to go to the cinema. We would like to go to travel abroad and to have cultural exchange with others. But unfortunately, we have been living in a blockade, in an open-air prison. We are forbidden to travel. We are forbidden to live just normal, just like you. So we demand from the international community to understand our request and our demand and help us actually to live normal, just like you, because we are in general came from one root, from Adam and Eve. And thank you. So much for you, what you're doing in the street. We saw you rally and your demonstration for kids in Gaza, for women in Gaza, and for every single civilian person who have been victim because of this aggression against Gaza. And thank you very much.
Well, my thanks, of course, go out to you for your words, your courage, and. We only wish there was something that we could do. Thanks again, though, for speaking with us today. My guest has been Mohammed El-Khattawi in Gaza.
Oregon's current election system lets party-affiliated voters decide their party nominees and those top vote-getters face off in the election. Under a proposed ballot initiative, everyone, regardless of political party, would get to select those top two vote-getters. Supporters of the measure say opening up the primary to one-third of Oregon's eligible voters, or 650,000 people who are currently independents or non-affiliated, will make elections more fair and dynamic. Don Merrill talked with James Kelly, the lead sponsor of the initiative, and Jane Carroll, a vocal opponent.
Measure 90, also known as Oregon's Open Ballot Initiative, is a little wonky, as Mr. Kelly admits, but it's important.
Currently, our system for primaries in the state of Oregon is what's called a closed primary system, and what that means is that you have separate ballots for Republicans and for Democrats, and then the minor parties as well as independents are shut out in the primary process in terms of their ability to vote on partisan races. So that's 650,000 out of registered voters in Oregon who are shut out. The open primary will change all of that. All of the candidates will be on one single ballot. There will no longer be separate Democratic and Republican primaries. Each party will be able to, including the minority parties, will be able to have run their own endorsement process. So everybody runs in the primary, and then the top two run in the general election. And on the ballot, if anybody running for office is registered with a party, that will show up. And then also, if any party has actually endorsed a candidate, that will also show up on the ballot in the general and in the primary, and that could include multiple endorsements from both major and minor parties.
Jane Carroll is a talk show host with KUIK in Hillsboro and a vocal opponent of Measure 90.
I think what it will do is turn it into a system like in the city of Portland, where you basically, at the end of the day, you'll have two liberal Democrats running against each other for every position. And it'll basically will block out third-party candidates and, of course, the Republicans in most cities and districts in this state, except for a handful of ones where it'll be two Republicans running against each other. I think it's very detrimental to the third-party system.
I wanted to ask you about the way the political power distribution is sort of distributed in the state right now. I mean, I've had a chance to talk to a fair number of politicians in advance of the May primary, and at least on the right, a lot of the Republican candidates talked about how Oregon is a traditionally, you know, not traditionally, but in the last few decades, it's been a Democratic state. And a lot of the Republicans wanted to try to reach out to independents, where they say about a third of the voting block is. How will this measure shift that power, if at all?
I personally don't think it'll shift it in any significant way. I'm a Democrat, and I'm certainly not doing this to empower the Republicans by any means. And demographically, all the information that we have about independents is that they're all over the map politically. It's not a group that skews to the right or to the left.
But the Oregon Democratic Party is putting together some money to try to fight your measure.
Oh, absolutely. They did before when there was a similar measure in 2008. And you know, you have to look at, you know, who fights this measure are those who feel that they have the most to lose if there's any kind of change. Now, whereas I'm saying I don't think that there's going to be change that's going to hurt the Democratic Party in any way. Right now, the Democratic Party, you know, holds all the statewide elected offices in both houses of the legislature. So they're just more fearful of any kind of change and are more interested in preserving the status quo. And I don't think the Republican Party has officially come out on this yet. They opposed it in 2008.
I don't agree with that. I think that's foolhardy. I think the independents will be voting in the race, and they tend to lean more to the left, and so more Democrats will benefit from the 650,000 independent voters that are in Oregon right now. I understand why they want to participate in the process, but they should register in the party to pick a party nominee.
So then you're doing this for the good of Oregon democracy?
I am. I'm working full time. I retired a couple years ago when I sold my business. This is, you know, I'm my joke is I'm telling everybody, don't retire or you can end up like me. I'm Exhibit A. I'm working day and night on this.
Absolutely not. This would basically turn Oregon into the city of Portland, and conservative voices will be shut out. Third-party candidates will be shut out. This will be an opportunity for two Democrats to run against each other statewide and for probably most legislative seats as well.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
And now this from National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A community loan fund in South Dakota is taking steps to build its internal capacity to serve the needs of growing larger businesses on the Pine Ridge Reservation. As Jim Kent reports, work is being done to increase awareness of business financing solutions and create or expand more businesses.
Lakota Funds has assisted in the startup of hundreds of small businesses on the Pine Ridge Reservation since it was founded 28 years ago. The Lakota Fund's executive director, Tawny Brunch, says those businesses are growing, and there are still many larger businesses that continue to face barriers in accessing capital.
Traditionally, we served more like the sole proprietorships, the quilters and the individual, maybe contractors, the smaller businesses. But we surveyed businesses and found that there are actually businesses out there who need more than $100,000 and are having a hard time accessing that capital, and that's keeping their businesses from growing.
At least two of those businesses are generating sales annually of over $3 million, says Tawny Brunch. A recent financial award from the City Foundation will permit Lakota Funds to build its internal capacity to handle larger loan requests by big businesses located on the reservation. Businesses on the Pine Ridge Reservation that need higher capital lending include those in the construction and building industry, as well as others in grocery and retail. The City Foundation's award provides Lakota Funds the ability to market in order to attract the kind of capital the Community Loan Fund will need to finance larger loans. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
Alaska veterans turned out for the first Veterans Affairs stand down in the community of Bethel. The recent event, put on by the government agency, helps connect veterans with services and benefits. KYUK's Charles Enoch has this report.
The most visible benefit to veterans was the several container vans full of military surplus gear, but Rick Epperson, Rural Health Program Manager for the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, says the gear was intended to connect veterans with bigger benefits they've earned.
Our main purpose here is to talk with veterans about many of the benefits that many of them don't even know that they qualify for.
Francis Udrik was an acting first sergeant for the 143rd Airborne, serving in Kuwait and Iraq in 2006. And 2007. He says signing up for benefits is important.
It helped me since I came back. I have more privileges and benefits from being disabled.
Some of those benefits are geared towards health care for veterans, which they can now get closer to home. Susan Yeager is the director for the Alaska VA healthcare system.
In May 2012, we were able to sign 26 contracts, sharing agreements with different Native organizations across Alaska. And so what that agreement says, any eligible veteran that's seen, then we, the VA, will reimburse for that care.
Yeager says over 100 veterans from the YK Delta signed up for the VA healthcare plan during their visit last week. Mike Frew, director of the VA Home Loan Program in Washington, D.C., was also in Bethel for the stand-down. In addition, he traveled to the YK Delta villages to work on memorandums of understanding that will help Alaska Native veterans get direct home loans from the VA.
I hope it helps a lot of veterans. I know that the home loan program we've had for 70 years, we've helped 21 million veterans and their families purchase homes, raise their children, and live a life and own a part of the American dream.
The MOU will make low-interest home loans available to Alaska Native veterans. The loans will have better rates than the standard VA home loans and can be used for remodeling. Last week, the first MOU was signed for Metlakatla in southeast Alaska, the state's only official reservation. Frew says 10 YK Delta villages have already signed their intent to sign an MOU. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
An official spokesperson for the NRA, Ted Nugent, will be performing for a concert tonight at the Portland Expo Center. Nugent was recently excluded from performing in Idaho and Tacoma, Washington casinos by the local Indian tribes due to Nugent's disrespect of Native cultures. MoveOn.org circulated a petition earlier this summer in protest against Nugent's appearance at the Clark County Fair. One of the organizations protesting the performance at Portland's Expo Center is Eradicating Offensive Native Masketry, or Eon Massac, which organizes against the misappropriate use of imagery culturally specific to Native people. The organization also held a protest at Waterfront Park this past Sunday against Flaming Lips about derogatory statements made about Native people, which KBOO reported on Monday evening yesterday. the Monday Evening News yesterday. Kibu Sukwana Wright spoke with Jackie Keeler of EONM today about the upcoming protest.
So I'm speaking with Jackie Keeler of Eradicating Offensive Native Mascotry, EONM Associ. This organization plans on protesting Ted Nugent, who will be performing at the Expo Center later on tonight, Tuesday night, at the Expo Center. Jackie, what is this protest about, and what is it about Ted Nugent that the organization is against?
Yes, the protest is about, we are protesting Ted Nugent for his misappropriation of Native culture, particularly of our headdress and also other sacred items of our culture, like the white buffalo calf. What he poses with white buffaloes, and these are really elements of our culture. I am Yankton Sioux, a Dakota, and these are really sacred elements of our culture, and really are not his to use as he would choose to. They are given by the people to our leaders. And the sacred items are really belong to the people, the Dakota and Lakota people.
Do you know how long Ted Nugent has been stealing from the Native American people in terms of their culture and headdress?
Quite a while, I'd say. I mean, and then he's, his reaction when he said a lot of really racist things, and when the tribal casinos recently, a couple of them chose to cancel his concerts, he basically, he called them unclean vermin, and it's just really, it's not, his behavior is completely unacceptable, and we are not at all representative of our culture and our beliefs and the way we treat each other.
Who have you talked to about this? Is there anyone higher up that you've contacted to get solidarity and help with to protest Ted Nugent?
Yeah, I've been talking I was very encouraged to see the recent letter that was written by the Office of Equity and Human Rights Director and in Portland. And so we would like to work with them. And because it is, as far as I know, it is a city-owned venue, the Expo Center. And we would like to work with the city to basically create guidelines for for hate speech, and also for misuse of our cultural of our culture. We EONM was recently worked in San Francisco with the Giants fiasco that happened, and we got the Giants to ban culturally inappropriate apparel from the game. So we would like something like that to happen here in Portland, whereby things like what he does would not be allowed.
Just this past Sunday, activists were at the Tom McCall Waterfront Park protesting against the Flaming Lips performance. Did your organization, EONM, have anything to do with that as well?
Yeah, we organized the protest. Yeah, so we had about 20 members there. And we protested Wayne Coyne. We had helped with a protest in Norman, Oklahoma back in April. Some Native people contacted us to tell us, what had happened, that they were going to be going on stage in full regalia, the band Pink Pony. And Wayne Coyne was with them on stage. And he proceeded to flip off jeer at Native protesters, and the crowd got involved. It got very ugly, and he didn't apologize. He later, he showed support for the Pink Pony. One of the members is the daughter of the Republican governor of Oklahoma, Mary Fallon, and he showed support for her daughter, Christina Fallon, by doing an Instagram picture, putting his dog in a headdress, and was not at all sorry. He gave kind of a fake apology a non-apology, and then proceeded to go back on stage wearing a headdress.
So, Jackie, what's next for EONM to continue showing that the natives in this organization and anyone supporting you is against these cultural entities?
Misappropriation?
Yes.
Yeah.
What's next
well,
for
we
EONM?
Would like to, our goal is to make what we call red face, which is dressing up in our regalia, playing Indian. And, you know, when you get the fans in these sports games with their mascots, they are clowning our culture. And we would like that to stop. And we would like for cities like Portland and San Francisco and Seattle and Los Angeles to basically, make resolutions in the public city-owned facilities that these be not allowed. That the wearing, if someone came to a stadium or someplace dressed in blackface, they would be turned away. And we want the same thing to happen when people come dressed up in redface. And we just want to be able to make it more and more unacceptable to appropriate our culture, to trivialize it, and to act like there are no consequences for it. I mean, because we are such a small proportion of the population in the United States, it's been easy to get away with it because Native voices are not heard. And so we've been using social media to make sure our voices are heard.
All right. Once again, I have been talking with Jackie Keeler of Eradicating Offensive Native Mascotry. And this organization, along with Jackie, will be protesting Ted Nugent at the Expo Center this evening, who will be performing. And the organization is protesting Ted Nugent from wearing headdress that is specific to the Native people. Thank you once again, Jackie.
Thank you.
And I'm Sequoia Wright with KBOO Evening News.
A young prisoner in Washington State who was found hanging in his cell a week ago has died. The 21-year-old had been left alone in his cell for an extended period in the Snohomish County Jail. He had been arrested 2 days before and charged with assault and theft. The young man had a history of mental health issues, but the Department of Corrections determined that their staff had followed procedures correctly in this case. He was screened for mental health issues during booking, but nothing that he said or did put up a red flag for the police or correctional officers. But 2 days later, he apparently hung himself in his jail cell. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with KBOO's Jimmy Tardy about the latest in drone developments in the United States, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes organizers of Rainbow in the Dark to discuss their traveling festival and their event happening in Portland on August 14th. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock Radio will finish up their in-depth look into the Palestine liberation, as well as commentary from Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report about U.S. mercenaries. Tomorrow's weather is a high of 79 degrees and a night low of 59 degrees and mostly clear skies. Today in history, August marks the month to honor fallen soldiers in the Black Power movement. Jonathan Jackson, George Jackson, William Christmas, James McClain, and Guattari Golden, who gave their lives in the late 1960s and early 70s to the Black Power movement, known as Black August. The soldiers in the movement were known as the San Quentin Six, and during their time in prison, spent time organizing the whole month of August. Black August was introduced to the hip-hop world in the late 90s after the political exile of Nahanda Abiodun. The quote of the day is, "But now with the living conditions deteriorating and with the sure knowledge that we are slated for destruction, we have been transformed into an implacable army of liberations." From Black August, inspiration and political prisoner, George Jackson. Oh. It's 5:30 time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
Perhaps you thought that surely partisan posturing by far-right Congress critters couldn't get any nuttier. But now comes the GOP's claim that all the talk about impeaching President Barack Obama is being led by, guess who? Barack Obama. The top Republican leader, John Boehner, having discovered that the larger public is appalled that his party would even consider wasting time on such extremist nonsense, tried to do a political backflip. Impeachment talk, he fumed, is, quote, a scam started by Democrats at the White House. No Republican lawmakers, he barked to the media, are even discussing it. Boehner, 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 did you not hear Steve Scalise of Louisiana, who's number two on your own GOP leadership team, tell Fox News that he refuses to rule out impeachment? Or Kerry Bentivoglio of Michigan exult that, quote, it would be a dream come true to impeach Obama, and that he has pursued advice on how to proceed? Or Iowa Steve King saying flatly, we need to bring impeachment hearings immediately? How about Randy Weber of Texas, who put it unequivocally, the president deserves to be impeached, plain and simple? And Georgia's Jack Kingston confirmed that not a day goes by when people don't talk to us about impeachment. Still, Boehner received some backup on his disclaimer from Tea Party radio ranter Glenn Beck, who echoed the speaker's ridiculous assertion that no one in the GOP has given a moment's thought to impeachment. Have you spoken to one person pushing such an idea, he demanded in a recent broadcast? No one has used the I word, he snapped. But in fact, Beck does know one person who has. Himself. Also, Sarah Palin, and at least a dozen others. This is Jim Hightower saying, put away all hope for honesty or seriousness, ye who enter the Nut House, presently known as John Boehner's U.S. House of Representatives.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Why in the world would Honeywell lock out its Metropolis, Illinois workforce twice since 2010, especially when the workers agreed to keep working while negotiations on a new contract continue? United Steelworkers Local 7669's John Paul Smith.
Under the company's current proposal, they could basically lay us off for any of a number of reasons and then backfill our jobs with a contractor. And because we weren't laid off for a direct result of the subcontracting, they could have the option to not call us back.
Smith says Honeywell is trying to break the union at the uranium conversion plant with this lockout by insisting on the right to systematically replace union workers with contractors over time.
What we're trying to achieve is we don't want one of our members to lose a job for any reason, if they retire, if they're terminated, if they just decide to quit, if they go out on medical reason, whatever happens, we don't want that job to be given to an out-of-town contractor. We want that job filled with someone local. I don't care if they're actually from here, if they want to move here, but we want that to be a local person, a bargaining unit member in that job, not an out-of-town contractor.
Illinois law allows these locked-out workers to get 52 weeks of unemployment compensation, and Smith says the United Steelworkers International Union is supporting the local. During the 2010-2011 lockout, the Metropolis, Illinois community supported the locked-out workers. A new round of labor contract talks is set to start August 18th. Workers in the Golden Gate Bridge Labor Coalition have authorized a strike if necessary after working without contracts since July 1st. The 450 workers belong to 13 different unions and include ferry deckhands and captains, bus servicers and mechanics, bridge iron workers and inspectors, and construction tradesmen and women. The workers say their compensation has lagged behind the high San Francisco Bay Area cost of living, a 12% gap, according to the unions. The unions want real wage increases to catch up to the increase in the cost of living, and they also want relief from proposed increases in health care premiums. The workers are urging the public to contact the Golden Gate Bridge District Board of Directors to urge a resolution at the bargaining table, rather than in a strike that could shut down the Golden Gate Bridge and ferries operating in the Bay Area. Palestinian garage workers in the West Bank are facing what they say is union busting by an Israeli employer. Workers at Zarvati Garage organized in the independent union, WACMON, and they decided to strike to defend their rights. The workers say the employer retaliated by fabricating security charges against union leader Hatem Abu Ziadeh. The Israeli employer worked with police to get the union leader's work permit revoked, according to the workers. An international effort to support these Palestinian workers and get their union leader reinstated has been launched on the Labor Start website. You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A new report has found that for-profit home health agencies are far more costly than nonprofit agencies. The nationwide study was published today in the August issue of the journal Health Affairs. The overall cost per patient was over $1,200 higher at for-profits, with operating costs accounting for $700 of the difference and excess profits accounting for nearly $500. Yet the quality of care was actually worse at for-profit agencies, and more of their patients required repeat hospitalizations. Researchers at the City University of New York School of Public Health analyzed detailed cost reports filed with Medicare by over 7,000 home health agencies in 2010 to 2011. They also examined government data on an additional 9,000 agencies. Compared to nonprofits, operating costs at for-profit agencies were nearly 20% higher. For-profits also did many more speech, physical, and occupational therapy visits, which are often highly profitable under the complex Medicare payment formula. In addition, profits at for-profit agencies added 15% on top of operating costs. Quality of care was worst in the South, where for-profit firms provide the overwhelming majority of care. Until 1980, Medicare barred for-profit agencies from its home care program, which covers homebound seniors who need skilled nursing care or occupational, physical, or speech therapy. At present, 88% of agencies are for-profit, and they care for 81% of Medicare home care patients. And now we go to Paul Cienfuegos for a new weekly segment of Taking Back Our Authority to Govern Ourselves.
Greetings. You are listening to the first ever weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Starting today and continuing every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News, I'll be sharing news and opinion about how we actually can dismantle corporate rule in this country, believe it or not, and replace it with authentically democratic structures of decision-making where we the people are in charge of our own communities. You may never have heard about the community rights movement because it's new in Oregon, but it's been active for the past 15 years, beginning in rural Pennsylvania in 1999, and then spreading across the Northeast. Thus far, 160 communities in 9 states have all decided to try something new, and are no longer begging and pleading with their elected and appointed officials. Instead, they have all passed legally binding and locally enforceable laws that recognize specific new rights for people and nature, that ban particular harmful corporate activities, and that strip corporations of their so-called constitutional rights. Whether you know it or not, corporate rights interfere in every aspect of our lives, and corporate directors utilize those rights in an amazing variety of ways. Corporations have the right to poison our air, water, and food. They have the right to interfere in our elections. They have the right to build big box stores everywhere. They have the right to clear cut our forests. They have the right to define the news. They have the right to send exploding oil trains through our communities. If corporations no longer had rights, their political and economic power would collapse like a house of cards. Very few of us pay much attention to how corporate rights affect the issues we care about, but that needs to change and fast. We simply cannot afford to keep fighting these battles one corporate harm at a time. We need to retool our activist strategies to become more effective, and part of that is learning our history. Corporations have been granted one new constitutional right after another, mostly by the Supreme Court, for almost 200 years, starting in 1819. These rights include free speech rights, property rights, privacy rights, contract rights, equal protection and due process rights, and most recently, the right to religious freedom. 160 communities have decided enough is enough.
in Pennsylvania, Maryland, Maine, New Hampshire, New York, Massachusetts, and most recently, New Mexico, Colorado, and Ohio, locally enforceable laws have been passed that have successfully banned corporate factory farms, corporate fracking, corporate water withdrawal for bottling, corporate dumping of sewage sludge on farmland, and corporate unsustainable energy projects. Imagine that. It's a brave new strategy, a new paradigm of legal thinking, a frontal assault on existing unjust laws. Town by city by county, we the people are once again learning how to exercise our inherent right to govern ourselves and to protect and defend the human and non-human residents in our communities. What corporate activities need to be stopped in your community? It's time to stop being so obedient and start imagining how to dismantle corporate rights where you live. You've been listening to the very first edition of the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News. I welcome your feedback. You can sign up for my newsletter or read today's commentary at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, an American general was killed along with another 15 soldiers in an apparent insider attack on a military base near Kabul, Afghanistan. Around half of those killed were U.S. soldiers. Among the wounded were a German brigadier general, two Afghan generals, and an Afghan officer. The attacker was dressed in an Afghan military uniform, but it was unclear whether he was a U.S.-trained Afghan soldier or just wearing the uniform in order to infiltrate the base. The Taliban issued a statement supporting the attack, which they said was not carried out by a Taliban fighter, but by an Afghan soldier. The U.S. general and other soldiers were taken unaware when one of the trainees in the Afghan army began to open fire on them. A U.S. official says many details of the attack early Tuesday are still unclear, and the numbers could change as more information becomes available. And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, August 5th, 2014. In Gaza, a three-day ceasefire halts Israeli bombardment, and in the West Bank, Israeli forces kidnap civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. As a 72-hour ceasefire took effect at 8 a.m. local time, the bodies of 15 Palestinians were recovered from under the rubble on Tuesday from different parts of the Gaza Strip, Palestinian sources reported. Initial reports by the Palestinian Ministry of Health says that 1,881 were killed and 9,570 were injured since Israel began its war on Gaza on July 8th. Among those killed, there are 430 children, the ministry reported. Moreover, among those injured, there are 2,877 children. The ministry announced that this number may increase as more bodies are still being recovered from under the rubble. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Ministry for Social Work announced on Tuesday that more than 10,000 structures, including homes, mosques, and schools, were totally destroyed in Gaza due to the Israeli bombardment and at least 30,000 sustained damage. In related news, and just before the ceasefire went into effect on Tuesday morning, Palestinian resistance groups fired several dozens rockets towards Israeli targets in retaliation of Israeli bombardment of different areas of Gaza. Some reports indicate that a long-range rocket apparently aimed towards the settlement of Gosh Etzion instead hit a Palestinian home in the town of Beit Sahur near the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem. The missile damaged one home and caused three minor injuries among family members living there. Earlier on Tuesday at dawn, Israeli forces invaded Beit Sahur and conducted house-to-house searches. Two kidnappings were reported as homes were ransacked by Israeli troops.
Moreover, Israeli soldiers invaded on Tuesday at dawn various Palestinian communities in the occupied West Bank and kidnapped at least 5 Palestinians.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Merrill. The producer and engineer and all-around news goddess for tonight's news is Sequoyna Wright. Special thanks to Jimmy Tardy and Air Cascadia host Chris Andre. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KABU News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Emily Young. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU at 7, it's Democracy Now! With hosts Juan Gonzalez and Amy Goodman. At 8, tune in for Talk Radio, where we take your calls on local, national, and international issues. At 9, it's the Michael Slate Show. The topic is, from the U.S. to Palestine, mass incarceration and genocide. When will the world say stop? Air Cascadia is at 10 with host Chris Andre, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's the KABU Bike Show, news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. That's all right here on KABU, your community connection. Thanks to all of you, all of our wonderful members. If it's because of you that KABU is able to remain independent and strong after 46 years. If you're not yet a member, you can become one now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for a live interview conducted by KABU reporter Jimmy Tardy.
Good night, Emily.
Good night, Sequoyna.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Jimmy Tardy, I'm joined on the phone by Colonel Ann Wright. She's a former United States Army colonel and a retired U.S. State Department official. She's been an outspoken opponent of the Iraq War. She's a recipient of the State Department Award for Heroism in 1997. She's a former State Department official. She was aboard the Challenger 1, which was part of the Gaza Flotilla. Colonel Wright has been traveling around the country and elsewhere on a number of anti-war and peace-related activities. She's worked with Cindy Sheehan at Camp Casey. She's known for shouting at former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to stop the war and stop the killing during a Senate Foreign Relations Committee meeting. She was a witness during the Article 32 hearing of U.S. Army Lieutenant Aaron Watata, who refused to deploy to Iraq with his unit, asserting that the war violates both the United States Constitution and international law. And that brings us to our topic, violations of international law related to the use of drones in drone warfare, especially controlled by the CIA. And these are, of course, the devices that have been used to murder more people at this point than were killed on September 11th, 2001, which has been a strong justification for their use. Colonel Wright, you're here in the Northwest. You'll be traveling around, and on Thursday, you are going to be one of the speakers at a panel that's going to take place at the First Unitarian Church of Portland. The doors will open at 6:30 p.m., and the program runs from 7 till 9:30. That's Thursday, August 7th. The panel will be titled, Drones at Home, What Are the Questions? Privacy, Safety, Economy, Legality, and Morality. The Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, they held a conference last year out in the Hood River Gorge, and they were very supportive of the idea of drones in general. And Colonel Wright, you are here to talk about the other side of drones and how they're being used
at this point in time.
Well, that's right. I'm very pleased to be here in the Portland area because drones are a fact of life now for America, both in our foreign policies as assassin drones that are being used in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, but also domestically where we have, at this point, unarmed drones that are being used in a variety of ways to the extent that the FAA is now trying to regulate them, and there are six test areas in the United States that Congress has mandated so that by the year 2016, there can be up to 30,000 unmanned aerial vehicles or drones that are to be integrated into commercial airspace, which for us as air travelers, I think we all want to make sure everybody knows what they're doing with these things, and particularly the commercial air pilots are very concerned about them.
We have, at this point in time, you mentioned the six areas that are being open for, I guess, test runs of these drones. Can you tell us a little bit about those areas?
Yes. Well, one of them is where I live, which is in Hawaii. There's a triangle between Alaska, Hawaii, and I believe the state of Washington that is being used as one of the test areas. There are five others that are in the continental United States, but they're in general in places where there is little commercial traffic and little populations. So in case there are problems with these drones, that hopefully they don't kill anyone. They do have a propensity to crash. Our military drones, which are the most prevalent drones that we have in America and have been used in Afghanistan and in Iraq, as well as Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, many of them have crashed. Some have crashed into each other. So the issue of collisions in our airspace with unmanned aerial vehicles colliding with commercial airliners is something that is really at the core of all of this. Even in the New York Times on Monday was an article about drones, and even small ones, they're now prolific enough that in New York City they're having collisions with them, small ones, because so many people are using them under 1,000 feet. So they are the growth industry in the aviation field now. There are more drone corporations that are popping up, everybody with a little bit different design, a little bit different capability. Most of them now will be able to carry cameras on them. So the issue of privacy, invasion of privacy, is one of the big concerns that they could be used to violate a person's privacy. They're so small that they can come through windows. They can fly around. You don't even realize that they're in your home. Somebody can be guiding them from, a quarter of a mile away and looking at a console, watching where the drone is going, guiding it, and actually invading your private home space with these little things.
So you're going to be part of a panel that includes Representative Jennifer Williamson, who will be speaking about privacy laws here in the state. You'll also be joined by Brian Whiteside, who is proponent of UAV innovation, likes to talk a lot about the economy. And also on the panel will be Peter Lumsdaine, who's the author of the book Robo Sapiens, Robotics, and Our Human Future.
There are some very good purposes for unmanned aerial vehicles where they can go out and monitor for long periods of time ecological situations, environmental situations, and hopefully will help us understand better what is happening with our climate and other things like that. So it's not that I'm totally against all unmanned aerial vehicles, but we do have to be very cautious on whether or not specific uses of them will violate our own civil liberties. And particularly on the issue of the weaponization of these things, where our military outside the United States is using them to assassinate people, and the international implications of that, the international legal implications, where you have the President of the United States who on what they call Terror Tuesday gets a list from our 16 intelligence agencies, a list of people that they think have done things that are a danger to U.S. national security, and so dangerous that they should be assassinated, that they should not be captured, brought to trial, but they should just be killed outright. And the President of the United States on Tuesday makes his determination on who on that list is going to live and who's going to die. And to me, it has meant that now the President of the United States is assuming powers that are not his. He is not the prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner by our Constitution. And yet that's what President Barack Obama has assumed as he makes the decision every Tuesday on who is going to be killed by these drones.
I was reading and preparing for this interview that it's very cheap and easy to equip a drone with a camera that has a 68-mile radius, that it can observe long periods, urban areas, what have you, and the resolution on this camera makes it possible to track individual people as they're walking through a 68-mile radius area. That's quite powerful technology. What do you think, you know, people need to do as far as, you know, sort of, I guess, preparing for the eventuality of drones taking over pretty much all of our airspace?
Well, I think that technology is currently on what's called the Global Hawk, which is the largest of the drones that the United States has. And the surveillance capability of that drone, which can go up to like 75,000 feet and stay airborne for, I believe it's 72 hours, is a remarkable capability. It was prepared to be a part of our international spying missions. It was not to be used for domestic surveillance. So that's one of the things that we have to be very watchful on, that our own government isn't using these things to spy on us domestically. Of course, we know that the NSA is spying on us through reading our cell phone or taking all the cell phone information and email information. So trying to push back from this wholesale government invasion of our privacy is something that is extraordinarily important for all of us.
When you say that the Global Hawk was intended for international surveillance, what's the basis for that remark that you make there?
Well, it's kind of a follow-on to, or a lighter version, I guess one would say, to the spy aerial vehicles that we have already, you know, like the U-2, which has a huge capability that can fly essentially around the world taking pictures. The Global Hawk has a similar type camera on it, but it can only stay airborne for like 72 hours, which is plenty of time to be surveilling a large swath of the international community. But what we need to be watchful for is if it's being used to spy on us for in the United States. We do have other types of aerial vehicles that do surveillance work. I mean, the highway patrols of many states have manned aircraft that fly over highways to check people if they're speeding, or you have helicopters that are doing surveillance work and monitoring, tracking specific individuals. But to have wholesale camera coverage for anybody that's in the area without a search warrant, which would have to encompass a huge number of people. I mean, a judge would be saying, essentially, I'll give you the authority to surveil everybody that's in this large piece of territory that plane would be covering. And I think that truly is an invasion of our privacy that we should push back from.
And we'll be able to hopefully talk with you more about that this coming Thursday at the First Unitarian Church of Portland. Doors open at 6:30. The program will be from 7 until 9:30 p.m. That's Thursday, August 7th. Drones in Oregon, Myths, Facts, and Futures, where my guest today, retired Colonel Ann Wright, who is also a former State Department diplomat, will be joined by Representative Jennifer Williamson, Brian Whiteside, who is a proponent of UAV innovation, Peter Lumsdaine, who is the founder of a group called AROS, which is the Alliance to Resist Robotic Warfare in Society, and of course yourself, Colonel Ann Wright. Thanks for talking with me. I'm sorry that we have just such a little period of time to talk about this important issue, but I do want to make sure that folks realize that you will be here in Portland Thursday, August 7th, 2014 at the First Unitarian Church of Portland, Southwest 12th and Salmon. Doors open 6:30, programs from 7 till 9:30 p.m. Drones in Oregon, Myths, Facts, and Futures. Is there anything else you'd like to say briefly before we have to go, Colonel Ann?
Well, I just would say that I have traveled to many of the countries where our assassin drones are being used. I have traveled to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen and talked with families of victims of our assassin drones. So the issue of weaponization of these drones in the United States by law enforcement organization is something that I'm sure we'll be bringing up on the panel, and I suspect everybody will be very anxious to prevent that happening here in the United States.
Okay. Thank you again, retired Colonel Ann.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yes, as retired Colonel Ann Wright. She'll be speaking Thursday, August 7th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland, part of a panel, Drones in Oregon, Myths, Facts, and Futures. We look forward to seeing you there, Colonel.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And they'll be mine, all mine, practicing 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest Film Center screening of The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T as part of the Cinema Under the Stars program on Thursday, August 7th at 7 p.m. The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T is a musical fantasy film with the story, screenplay, and lyrics written by Dr. Seuss. Before the film, the Grand Style Orchestra will be playing a set of improvisational free jazz music. Again, that's The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, part of the Top Down Cinema series